My name is Lenana Gal. I'm from Israel and I'm a co-president of Students for Justice in Palestine. I wonder if you can share some more of your thoughts and ideas and takes about what's going on right now in Israel, which is also an implication of the occupation. Right now in the news, there is the case in Jaffa that the government annexed more Palestinian neighborhood in order to build, right now it's a synagogue for the Jewish community and other Jewish neighborhoods. So I'm wondering if you maybe share with you American citizens what can you take of the United States about the domestic issues with the Palestinians in Israel. Thank you.
Yeah, actually that's quite important, another topic, but since it wasn't specifically the occupation, I'll talk about it. But it's what's happening in Israel now is very dangerous, I think. There's a very sharp drift to the ultra-nationalist, extremist right. And in fact, to go back to South Africa, that's pretty much what happened there. When you get through into the 1970s and into the 1980s, as you know, the international opposition became stronger and increased and became implemented in sanctions and boycotts and so on. South Africans reacted, I mean, they varied, of course. There were some who struggled against apartheid, but the large majority and the government reacted by just becoming more repressive, violent, circling the wagons, saying, okay, the world doesn't understand us, the world's against us, we're perfect, nobody understands us, so we'll just become harsher and more brutal. And they just, you know, almost in your face, like there was a contact group under Carter that was trying to arrange something about Namibia. South Africa held the territory of the World Court, the United Nations, and argued that it's totally illegal, they have to give it up. But South Africa wanted it. They had a big port, there were whites living there. Right at the point where the contact group was Europe and basically the United States with a couple of European allies. Just as they were meeting to try to achieve a settlement, South Africa picked that moment to carry out a murderous attack on an Angolan refugee camp in Kasinga, killing 600 people. It's the kind of thing that Israel's doing. Just saying, well, okay, you don't like us, we'll show you, we'll be tough and brutal. And internally, the rules became more brutal too. And Israel's reacting very much the same way. I mean, first of all, they're moving towards an extreme form of irrationality. I mean, it's almost shocking. Like the treatment of the Turkish ambassador, you know, their one ally, just purposely insulting and humiliating him. It just doesn't happen in diplomatic circles. Lieberman, foreign minister, just did the same thing to the prime ministers of France and Spain, told them, you know, get lost in a very ugly terms. Then Netanyahu is just doing the same right now to Obama. I mean, it happens in minor ways too, like, I mean, I was a minor example myself. In May, I was invited to talk at Birzeit, the Palestinian University. My friends and I decided to go in through Amman, because if you get turned back at nobody who's Jewish ever gets turned back, but we thought there's a possibility. So because of what's happening in Israel, if you get turned back at the Allenby Bridge, you just have to go back to Amman. You get turned back at Ben Gurion Airport, got to come back to the United States. We were going on to Beirut. So we went in, and the Ministry of Interior wouldn't allow me in. When there was an international protest, it's a minor incident, but it's again shooting themselves in the foot. If they allowed me to go to Birzeit to give a talk, as I've done many times before, nobody would even know. Okay, but this way, you know, international press, protests, so on. But they then tried to lie their way out of it and say that it was a border official that didn't know what he was doing, but that was totally untrue. It was the Ministry of Interior the whole way. And what they were upset about was interesting. You could see from the questions that a couple of hours my daughter and I were kept there for interrogation. It was basically one question. How come you're going to lecture in a Palestinian university and you're not going to Israel? If I'd said, okay, I'll go to Israel and talk at, you know, Tel Aviv University, that would have been fine. But the idea that a Palestinian university could invite somebody to speak actually on American foreign policy that had nothing to do with Israel-Palestine, the idea that they could do that was intolerable. And that's, again, just a minor example of irrationality. The Mavi Marmara, you know, the attack on a ship, Turkish ship in international waters, murdering people, that's much more serious. And but they're acting kind of the way South Africa did, and internally as well, as in the example you mentioned, but also in a series of laws that are coming through. If you want to have a look at them, there's a small article by Neve Gordon, an Israeli professor at Ben-Gurion, in the London Review of Books, and I think maybe the last issue, in which he just runs through some of the laws that are being considered and already passed the cabinet and will be implemented in Israel, and they're really pretty ugly. One of them, which I think is just about to be implemented, requires that non-Jewish immigrants have to declare loyalty to Israel as a Jewish state. Okay, that's like, as Neve Gordon points out, it's like somebody, an immigrant to England, being compelled to declare loyalty to the Anglican Church. You know, the civilized countries don't do that. They say non-Jewish immigrants for a reason. A lot of the Jewish immigrants won't do it. Orthodox Jews, for example, will not agree to that. So you've got to make it a racist distinction. There's another law coming along, which would actually criminalize statements to the effect that Israel's not a Jewish state. That's pretty extreme. You know, it's like in England, you know, law saying you have to. It's a criminal act not to say it's an Anglican state. The Anglican Church is the official church. You know. You know, and a series like that, one of them, which is really important and isn't discussed much, has to do with the land laws. The most racist laws in Israel since 48 have been the land laws. There's a complex, I wrote about it years ago, you can look it up, but what it comes down to is that over 90% of the land was placed under the authority of an organization, Keren Kayemet, Jewish National Fund, which has a charter with the State of Israel, in which it's stated that they can act only for the benefit of people of Jewish race, religion, or origin. Okay, that's the wording. You pay for that, all of you, because it's tax-free. It has tax-free status in the United States. So when you pay your taxes, you're paying for an organization that controls over 90% of the land in Israel through various arrangements, and must act for people of the benefit of people of Jewish race, religion, and origin. And not many countries could get away with this, maybe none. Well, that was finally overcome. There are civil rights groups in Israel. In the year 2000, they brought a case to the High Court. A case involved an Arab couple, professional middle-class couple, who wanted to buy a home in a Jewish town. And that went, you know, through the courts, finally reached the High Court, Supreme Court, and they ruled against it, which is quite important. That formally overturned the land laws, but then followed something which we're all very familiar with in the United States, a series of measures to try to get around it. So, in fact, one of them is now the law hasn't really been implemented, but it's on the books. Now there's a proposal in the Knesset to allow a community to refuse admission to any family that isn't congenial to the community, you know, or that has a culture different from that of the community. In other words, Arabs, you know, Palestinian citizens. Not unfamiliar in the United States, actually, I've gone through it myself, but ugly, you know, and there are other proposals like that coming along. Israel's just becoming a very ugly country in many ways, which was not true before, and I think the South African analogy is pretty appropriate. That's what happened there.
Given what's been happening with the dedications of types, as an example, types of different squares in Ramallah after martyrs and other things like that going on, What is your opinion of the Islamization of the conflict, and whether it adds or detracts to the Palestinian cause and legitimacy?
So how does it help or detract from the Palestinian cause and its legitimacy? Well, personally, I think that that's harmful everywhere. It's harmful all over the world. There is a rise of sort of religious fundamentalism in many parts of the world, including the United States, and I think it's extremely harmful. You can understand it, you can think of reasons for it, but whether it's Islam or Christianity, as it is here, or Hinduism, as it is in India, it's pretty ugly. I think it's very harmful to the Palestinian cause. And so that's not something foreign to us. We should bear in mind that part of the reason for this kind of outlandish U.S. support for Israeli crimes is Christian Zionism. Christian Zionism long precedes Jewish Zionism. It goes well back into the 19th century. And in a country like the United States is kind of off the spectrum in religious extremism in the Western world. I mean, about a third of the population in the United States believes in the literal word-by-word truth of the Bible. And the Bible says, God promised the land to the Jews. So therefore, anything they do is right, and we got to support it. That was a sort of a passive phenomenon in the United States until the last 20 or 30 years, when party managers recognized that they could mobilize this force as a force against everything that they don't like, civil rights, human rights, and in this case, in favor of support for Israel. In fact, Israel has a special kind of mission, even special newspapers, to appeal to the fundamentalist evangelical community, which is substantial. I should add that they are the most anti-Semitic people in the world, in history, in fact. If you literally take a look at the end times literature, which has been developing since in parallel with the establishment of Israel, really took off in 48. That was taken to be, the sign God is telling us, Jews are going back to Palestine. 1967 gave another big shot in the arm. This appeals to a large part of the population, huge, in fact. Their line is that they want to see a conflict, a battle between the Jews and the Arabs or the Iranians or the Russians or anybody, which will end up in Armageddon, which they all slaughter each other, and the souls who are saved rise to heaven, and Jesus comes, and you have 1,000 years of peace, and so on and so forth. Actually, for some reason, I don't know why, 144,000 Jews get saved. Don't ask me why. But the rest get exterminated and go to eternal damnation. I mean, even Hitler didn't go that far. But that's the group that's the strongest support for Israel in the United States, and that is being mobilized by Israel and by political leaders and so on. So that's one manifestation of this. And when it happens in, with Hamas and Gaza, or to an extent in the West Bank, it's equally, doesn't have that power, but it's the same dangerous kind of phenomenon. It's happening in many places, and it's quite dangerous. I think you're right to bring it up.
My name is John. You had some unkind words earlier for the state of scholarship in the U.S. And in particular, in the last 10, 15 years, there's been a growing wave of delegitimization and, assault on academic freedom particularly.
Of?
Assault on academic freedom.
Attack on it.
Middle East studies, scholars of Islam, and international relations scholars. So I was wondering if you could comment on that and the possibilities for people in the academy to fight back.
Yeah. So the issue is the attack on academic freedom, especially with relate to Middle East studies. It's real. I'm not sure how new it is, frankly. It's been going on for a long time. So Middle East studies, for example, is quite different from, say, Latin American studies. Compare the two professional associations. In the case of the Latin American Studies Association, typically when the U.S. Carries out atrocities somewhere or invades some country or whatever, what the press does is go to the local university and get an expert who can be confidently assumed to preach the government line. Okay, that's, for example, what mostly happened in Vietnam. Happens in Israel all the time, easy. Latin American studies, they couldn't do it. When U.S. atrocities began to mount in Latin America through the 60s, ending up with horror stories in the 80s, the Latin American Studies Association would not provide the ideological support. I mean, a few did, but most didn't. In fact, they condemned the actions. There were people who really cared about the countries where they work. So the media had to invent a new cadre of apologists. Couldn't go to the local university. Go through the details if you like, but they picked a series of people who became, you know, were designated to be experts, nothing there, and they gave the official line. So then the press could appear to be neutral, you know, they're just going to experts. Middle East studies has never been a problem. You can always get Bernard Lewis, and, you know, the rest of them. You can turn to the Washington Institute of Near East Policy. It's an offshoot of AIPAC, which the press pretends they know better, is an independent scholarly agency, and so on and so forth. It's been there for a long time. There are also now, I don't want to say it's not exactly what happened with South Africa, but there are similarities. And now that popular opinion is very notably turning against Israeli crimes, not against U.S. Israeli crimes, because that aspect is suppressed, but it should be that. But what they're turning against Israeli crimes, there's a growth of organizations trying to beat it back and denounce it and condemn it, like the David Project, for example, and others. You know, their goal is to try to suppress any discussion of these issues. You couldn't do that in the case of South Africa, because there was no support for apartheid. You know, you could, I mean, maybe you could do it in the John Birch Society or something, but in major sectors, there was essentially no support for apartheid. In this case, it hasn't gone that far by any means, but opposition is growing, notably. I mean, look, I've given talks on this topic in Brandeis for many years. Back in the 90s, when I tried to give a talk on this issue, the meeting was just broken up. Literally, you know, students would get up and scream, and, you know, have to stop the meeting. In fact, I remember one talk, must have been 95 or so, when I was talking about these issues, but the protests were so violent, and I had one friend who was in the back of the room, an Israeli actually, served in the Israeli army and so on. He tried to break up the he was called on to ask a question, and he tried to sort of turn it back to something sensible, so he asked a sensible question. But the audience started screaming at him, you know, Boged, you know, traitor, you know, you can't do that, you know, got to scream and have tantrums. That was in the mid-90s. I remember another talk a couple of years ago where it wasn't that bad, but there was literally airport security. You couldn't get into the auditorium without opening your bag, you know, pocketbook, backpack, whatever it might be, and getting inspected. Well, today, you know, some people walked out. It's a big change, and that change is all over the country. I mean, I could give you details from. I used to literally have police protection at major American universities if I was giving a talk on this issue. I know half the cops in Cambridge because they had to come to meetings. But that's all gone, and it's a sign of the substantial change in attitudes. In fact, you know, by now it's extremely hard to get a hostile question. It used to be impossible to get anything but diatribes. Well, okay, with that change, which is very visible, there's an attempt to beat it back. And that's, I think, what you're talking about. Partially it's been successful, but not too much, actually. There are a few cases which are deplorable, but by and large, I think it's been held in check.
Professor Chomsky. Hi, I'm Jason Olson, PhD student in Near Eastern Judaic Studies. I've heard a lot of things about you, but I was very relieved to know that you're correct about on many of your facts. Question, comment that I wanted to pose to you, I know you haven't had a chance to explore it much, but on Christian Zionism, there's two trends. You're right about this Christian apocalyptic Zionism. There's also Christian humanistic Zionism, which comes from historical guilt stemming from Christian anti-Semitism. And there is, Jews as chosen people wanting to support Israel to prevent Jewish deaths. I want to know if you've explored Christian humanistic Zionism and how you see it as a role in helping the peace process.
Well, who did you have in mind specifically?
There's pockets of...
There are pockets.
Christians United for Israel, other...
Yeah. Sure.
Humanistic,
yeah, I understand.
Historically informed intellectual Christians.
When you talk about the rise of fundamentalism, say Islamic fundamentalism, you can say the same thing. There are pockets of it that have a humanistic origin and drive. But if you look at the general phenomenon, I think what I said is a pretty good first approximation. And it also reaches all the way to high places, like to the presidents, to the White House. I don't know how many of you know this, but George W. Bush, who was part of this, in this would have been January 2003, when Bush was trying to get support from Western powers for the invasion of Iraq, he met with the French president, Chirac, and he started. He started what Chirac took to be raving about. He started citing passages in Ezekiel, very obscure passages which nobody understands. There's a passage in Ezekiel about Gog and Magog, coming from the north and doing terrible things. Nobody knows whether Gog and Magog are people or places or what they are, but they play a role in sort of this Christian, eschatology. The way I found out about this was from a Belgian theologian who sent me a disquisition that he wrote on this passage from Ezekiel with a message saying he had sent it to the French government. And I sort of worked it out, and it's been verified in biographies of Chirac and so on. What happened is Chirac didn't understand what this maniac was talking about. So he asked the Foreign Office, the Elysee, what's this guy raving about? And they didn't have any idea. So they approached this Belgian theologian, well-known Belgian theologian, who gave him a long description of, the passage and what it's meant and ultra-right, extremist Christian thought and so on. But Bush evidently believed it. And in fact, if you go back to Reagan, his handlers kept him pretty well under control. But in the cases where he got off by himself, he started talking about these things. I think this is, how serious it is, I don't know. But it's a big part of American culture, and it's very, very effective. There is Christian humanism, certainly. But I think Christian humanism is in the, you find it, say, in the National Council of Bishops, who are critical of U.S.-Israeli policies. That's Christian humanism. The idea that you'd support Israel to save Jews is very strange, because the Israeli government doesn't try to save Jews. I was pointing out that they follow policies which prefer expansion to security. Now, they're not unique in that. That's pretty common among states. The mythology is states don't want to protect their citizens. It's certainly not true. Take, say, the invasion of Iraq. The invasion of Iraq was undertaken with the expectation that it was going to increase terror. That was what the intelligence agency said, both British and American. That's what specialists said, and so on. And it happened much more than was expected. In fact, terror increased by a factor of 7 after the invasion of Iraq, way beyond what was expected. But that's pretty typical of state behavior. and Israel's no exception. And if you look, I mean, they could have security right now. You know, you want to save Jews, fine. Accept the international consensus. No, security, everybody agrees. But that's not state behavior. And I think if there are groups that think they're helping save Jews by supporting Israeli policies, I think they're pretty misguided. They look at the history and the current situation. But yes, you're right, they're there. I don't think they're the major force. I should say there are other reasons to explore, if we're serious about it, about why you have popular support for Israel. And a lot of these reasons are not very pretty. I mean, there are reasons having to do with, you know, strategic analysis and so on and so forth. But I think one fundamental reason, which I don't think has been explored much, is that the United States is a settler colonial society. Settler colonial societies are absolutely the worst form of imperialism because it means you wipe out the indigenous population. I mean, you know, there were people living here before the colonists came from England. They're gone. And they were gone because that was the will of God. There's a streak of what's called providentialism, which runs right through American history from the founding fathers right up till today, which says, whatever we do, it's God's will. And I could run through the details, they're interesting, but this says when the colonists came, they came in order to help the Indians by exterminating them. And then you get commentary, you know, by Supreme Court justices and people who said, this is kind of strange. We came here to help them, but they're withering away like the leaves of autumn, you know. Well, God's ways are mysterious. This is a deep streak of American history. And many people just intuitively see Israel as reliving it. And that's intensified by the fact that, you remember, the United States was settled by religious extremists. These were people who were waving the holy book while they were calling themselves the children of Israel, you know, coming to the promised land, and you have to exterminate the Amalekites, you know. I mean, that goes right from the beginning of American history, right up to the present. And I don't know how to measure it exactly, but I suspect that that's part of the sort of cultural background for intuitive support. Not pretty, but imperial conquest never is, and settler colonialism is the worst.
My question is, perplexed at what you said earlier about the fact that Israel can perform self-defense, but not for violence. So, could you elaborate on that? Or?
Can
the fact that Israel can perform self-defense?
Self-defense without violence?
It's easy.
Take Qassam rockets. I think the one, you know, one threat they feel they have. They know exactly how to stop the Qassam rockets, namely reinstitute the ceasefire, as Hamas has requested. During the ceasefire, crucial fact, during the ceasefire, even though Israel didn't live up to it, they maintained the siege, which is an act of war. Although Israel didn't live up to it, Hamas did. There were no Hamas rockets, period. Not my opinion, that's the official Israeli assertion.
Starting when?
June 2008, when the ceasefire was instituted.
What about preceding 5 years?
Preceding 5 years, it was mostly Israeli attacks. Mostly, overwhelmingly, in fact. I went through much of them. The main attack started almost immediately after the staged withdrawal. January 2006, that's when the U.S. and Israel imposed a harsh sanctions in reaction to the Palestinian election. It was pretty bad. If you go to June 2006, it was very bad. There were very serious Israeli attacks on Gaza, murderous attacks. In June 2007, the next year, when Hamas beat back the U.S. attempt to overthrow the government by a military coup, at that point, the U.S. and Israel imposed an extremely harsh siege. Now, that's an act of war. That's a serious act of war. And Israel, of all countries, accepts that. Remember that Israel went to war several times because it claimed that it was being threatened by a siege. in 1967, the justification for the Israeli war was that Egypt was threatening access through the Gulf of Tehran. Now, that was a threatened minor siege, and Israel regarded it as an act of war. We could debate whether that was right or not, but certainly the siege on Gaza is far more extreme. So that's a major act of war. It's combined with constant military attacks, assassinations, invasions, and so on. And yes, there were rockets that, minimal rockets that Hamas fired, which is of course a criminal act in itself. And Israel knows precisely how to stop them. Just accept the ceasefire means ending the criminal siege, and you're done. No Qassam rockets. They don't want it, because it's another case of how states prefer expansion and domination to self-defense.
Well, there's no opportunity, really, in this setting, for any of the other points you've made tonight.
Why is
so
there
that
not?
Can't happen tonight, but I wish
why isn't there any?
Some people in this room might ask, in the aftermath of this, I, by the way, have been present at all your talks at Brandeis, and don't recognize the description of the opposition to you. But
really?
We have different memories of that. But at any rate,
I'll be glad to document it if you like.
I would think the students in this room are very interesting comments. Would be interested in exploring it and maybe
exploring
thinking
what?
About it critically.
Exploring
in the life that which really goes on after you leave.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't know what issue you're
I'm
raising.
I'm talking to the audience, not to.
What
okay.
Yeah, what
Thank
issue?
You, no. Thank you.